this was the only evidence that was sort of injected into the situation on 9/11, giving us the story of the hijackings. When you sort of pick it apart, you can basically prove that the alleged hijacking events did not take place, right? And these and the story that we've been given is a total fraud.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to The Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you in September of 2024, specifically September 23rd, or the 22nd, depending which side of the dateline you happen to be on. And today we're going to be talking to a guest that I hope you are familiar with today. But if not, well, let's introduce him, bring him on to talk about a very important subject surrounding the events of September 11th, 2001. And that is specifically Ted Walter of the International Center for 9/11 Justice at IC911.org, an organization that I have talked about before, so I hope you are familiar with them. But if not, well, let's bring him on board and find out more about it. Ted Walter, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me. Great to see you.
All right. Excellent. Well, just to make sure everybody is on board, let's talk a little bit about the International Center for 9/11 Justice. What is this IC911.org? When and where and how did it start and why?
Sure. Yeah. So the organization was formed in, I want to say 2009, either 2008 or 2009. And it was originally called the International Center for 9/11 Studies. And it was started by my colleague, who's an attorney. His name is James Gourley. And I think the most notable thing that the organization did in those early days was organize and host the Toronto hearings in 2011. So on the 10th anniversary, and brought together, many of the leading researchers in the 9/11 truth movement at that time to present their research, as of that moment in time. And after that, the organization, a year later, produced a report on the hearings. So the 9/11 Toronto report, kind of mimicking the 9/11 Commission report in terms of its style and whatnot. And people might have also seen DVDs and documentaries about the hearing. So and did a few other things, major FOIA releases and whatnot. But it kind of went dormant for several years after that. And then a year and a half ago, I approached sort of the people that were still involved with the organization, James Gourley, Graham McQueen, David Chandler, and so on, about kind of rebooting it and bringing it together with the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which has sort of already been a sister organization of the International Center, and also the 9/11 Consensus Panel, which was led by David Ray Griffin and Elizabeth Woodworth, and to kind of bring these under one umbrella to make it easier for people to find this information, and then also to conduct new research, new, hopefully groundbreaking research, and also raise public awareness, et cetera. So we've sort of been at it since June, a year ago, a little over a year, and done several things in that time. And, most recently, as we're going to talk about, we hosted this symposium on the aviation aspects of 9/11.
And of course, for those who don't remember, you were, of course, responsible for presenting that wonderful documentary of Graham McQueen and his final interview, as it were. And the name of that documentary is going to completely slip my mind at the moment, so you will remind me.
Peace, War, and 9/11.
I thought it was Peace, Justice, and 9/11, but good. Okay, Peace, War, and 9/11. Again, people who haven't seen that documentary, highly recommended. I really suggest people check it out. Dr. Graham McQueen, late, great Dr. Graham McQueen, always an excellent, excellent source of information about 9/11. But today we're going to be getting into, as you say, some of this newer and groundbreaking research. How can there possibly be newer and groundbreaking research on this 23-year-old event? Well, there's a lot of areas of 9/11 research that have not been given enough attention over the years, as other aspects of 9/11 have really dominated people's attention. So one aspect of that I see on the website, IC911.org, I'll throw a link into your latest symposium, which was a four-hour mega lecture by a bunch of different speakers, including yourself, on aviation impossibilities, deconstructing the official story of the 9/11 hijackings and air defense failures. I think that title is fairly self-explanatory, but tell us, in your own words, who was there and what they were talking about.
Yeah, so the research director of the center, Piers Robinson, hosted it and facilitated, and we also had Captain Dan Hanley of 9/11 Pilot Whistleblowers give a talk at the beginning of it. And then we got into four different presentations. I was the first person to present, and I spoke about the hijackings, or the hijacking story, and kind of the, not only, well, I'll get into it in a little bit, but you know, basically showing, being able to use the phone call evidence primarily to show that the hijacking story is completely unfounded. We also had speakers talk about how we were basically the first step in our research as an organization. We said we already know a lot about the demolition of these buildings, right? And that's pretty well established, and it's out there. Activists have been talking about it for years, et cetera. Where we really don't know enough, where we really want to nail things down in the next few years, is what happened in the skies, what happened to the planes, what this hijacking story, how the planes were flown, et cetera, et cetera. So it was the first step in our research process over the last year has been to just sort of just what not trying to show what happened, but show what didn't happen. So we were really attacking the official story, which is the planes were hijacked by these hijackers. Then they somehow managed to navigate them to their targets. And then the U.S. air defenses completely failed to stop them, right? So the presentations basically revolved around those three claims. So mine was the hijackings. Then we had a pilot talk about sort of the impossibility of the alleged hijackers being able to navigate and fly the planes. And then, you know, the flip side of that is we had a researcher, Aidan Monahan, talk about remote guidance capabilities, remote guidance technology. Flying the planes remotely or, you know, under computer control. And lastly, Kevin Ryan, who's been the editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, or co-editor since 2006, talked about the air defense failures and sort of the shifting, evolving, multiple versions of the stories as to why the U.S. air defense has completely failed to stop these, so, you know, allegedly hijacked planes. It was very dense, a lot of information. I think that's been sort of the feedback. Maybe you yourself watched it or large part of it. Sort of that's the first step in our research process. And I think a lot of it's not completely groundbreaking, but we're kind of proceeding very deliberately, methodically, first sort of disproving the official story. And then we get into, okay, what really did happen?
Yes. Excellent. Yeah, that's a good overview. And yes, it is a massive 4-hour symposium, and I have only managed to carve out time for 2/3 of it so far. But yes, dense would be the way I'd describe it. Lots and lots and lots of factual information and sources to back it up. So that's the kind of research that I'm interested in. And if people out there are also interested, of course, the link will be in the show notes, so you can go and watch the full symposium. But as you say, you were talking specifically about the hijackings that supposedly occurred and the evidence, or lack thereof, for such events actually taking place in the skies. And I think most, well, debunkers of 9/11 truth, but also the sort of general public would assume, well, there was all those phone calls, there were multiple phone calls from multiple people talking about hijackings, identifying these Middle Eastern looking men, and we have some of the cockpit transmissions, and we know about Let's Roll, and all of that. So obviously, what they say happened on 9/11 happened on 9/11, right? So how can you possibly start to deconstruct that? Tell us about, first of all, why and how did you get interested in the topic of the phone calls? And then what did you discover when you started diving in?
Yeah, so in a pretty generic way, as we were saying, we got to understand more about what happened in the skies. You know, the 9/11 phone calls was on that list, right? So I started diving into it. I started reading, you know, the research that's been done over the years. And, you know, I was pretty surprised about what I found. The limited dialogue that there has been, or the limited research and discussion around the phone calls that's happened over the past 20 years, has mostly revolved around the technology of the calls, right? Were they cell phone calls? Cell phone calls can't be made from those altitudes. Were they airphone calls? You know, why did these calls, for people that have even dug into the weeds at all, why did some of these calls last beyond the time that Flight 93 allegedly crashed, right? Two of the calls went well beyond that. Maybe we'll get into that a little bit. But so on and so forth. Just all about the technology, with maybe little bits of people research saying, like, his behavior seems kind of weird, or why did Mark Bingham introduce himself as Mark Bingham to his mom, right? So which just sort of lend itself maybe to the impersonator voice morphing theory of how these calls were made. But very little analysis had been done into sort of like statement analysis, actually dissecting what's being reported in the calls, and does it make any sense, you know? And so really only a small handful of researchers started to do that, and really like sort of post 2010. And so I sort of started building on their research. And, you know, somebody who goes by the pseudonym of Loop-de-Loop did a really fascinating deep dive into the calls made from Flight 11. And you can find that if you Google, like, Loop-de-Loop, Flight 11, something like Fog Fiction and then Flight 11, you could find that series. Another researcher, Elias Davidson, sort of did a broad look at all the phone calls. I started to look really closely at Flight 93 because there were so many calls, and I was sort of like, if you actually look at these and then organize them chronologically as to when they were made, maybe we can sort of start to see, read between the lines and see through the cracks here as what is actually going on this plane, if these people were really on the plane or if they were what have you. So really it was to say, like, do a statement analysis of the calls. What's in the content of the calls? And Flight 93, as well as all of the other calls, when you start to actually examine what is being reported purportedly by these passengers and flight attendants, you none of it adds up. As you might expect, none of it adds up to the extent that, since this is the only evidence really supporting that, this was the only evidence that was sort of injected into the situation on 9/11, giving us the story of the hijackings. When you sort of pick it apart, you can basically prove that the alleged hijacking events did not take place, right? And the story that we've been given is a total fraud. In Flight 93, because there were so many calls made from Flight 93 by so many people, the total number of calls, I isolated 18 people across the four different flights who made a total of 28 calls that conveyed any information at all. There were also like calls that didn't get connected and this and that, but 18 callers of 28 calls, 12 of those were on flight 93 or thereabouts. Something like that. So, I can dig into the details, but that was sort of the genesis of it. And then I realized, like, we wanted to, for this presentation, I decided not to get into how were the calls made. Were they made with airphones, or were they made by the passengers, or were they made by people impersonating them, or what have you? I just wanted to focus on, like, what is being reported in the calls, and figuring out how they were made is kind of like the next step of our research, essentially, over the next, let's say, year or two. I can dig into it when you're ready.
Let's go into it. And I don't know how you want to do it, flight by flight or whatever. But for people who want the full presentation, obviously, we'll direct people there for, as you say, you have all the slides with all of the phone calls and what was said. But let's just start getting into some of the highlights or lowlights of what you found.
The interesting thing about Flight 93, what distinguishes it from the other flights, was there were actually purported radio transmissions, purportedly that came from the flight as at the moment that the plane was allegedly being taken over. So this was at 9:28 a.m. on the morning of 9/11. So about 25 minutes after the second plane hit the second tower, Flight 93 is allegedly taken over by hijackers. And so there's two transmissions that are about 30 seconds apart. Just prior to that, the plane dipped about 600 feet. And then 5 seconds later, you get the first transmission. 30 seconds later, you get the second transmission. And in both transmissions, you can sort of hear the pilot saying, "Mayday, mayday." It's very odd. I spoke with several pilots about this. And it's just, first of all, very odd that a pilot would say mayday, that would be the choice of words used in that moment. Now, of course, I'm supposed to imagine he's fighting for his life and, somebody's trying to stab him, what have you. But to just, on both transmissions, use that word and then not give really any more information is pretty odd. And in the second transmission, which I would love to play for your audience, you basically hear the same exact set of words and sounds repeat in a loop. Now, I don't think it's like the same exact audio waves repeating. Like, it's not like done per se like that, but it is really the same exact set of words and sounds that repeat in a way that it sounds completely inauthentic. So if you want to give that a listen.
Yes, I have that audio ready, so let's give it a listen.
That's American 1060.
Bizarre,
yeah. So you sort of hear him say, "Mayday, get out of here." Mayday, get out of here. So it's like, anyway, I'm hoping that we can do some analysis on this and kind of prove definitively that it's not sort of authentic sound being generated, you know, by a fight going on in the cockpit. But the more important thing about those radio transmissions is that they establish that the official story has basically committed itself to a violent hijacking taking place, a violent takeover of the cockpit taking place at 9:28 a.m., whereas we don't have that sort of concrete cornerstone of the story with the three other hijackings. In fact, almost none of the passengers across the 18 callers, the 28 calls that were made, describe how the hijackers entered the cockpits, how they overcame the pilots, what happened to the pilots. There's only two callers that give any sort of vague mention of any sort of like what happened to the pilots. An unidentified flight attendant on flight 175, which is the second plane hit the second tower, says that the pilots are dead. Okay, doesn't give any more information to how that happened. Strangely enough, the other callers from flight 175 don't say what happened to the pilots. That's pretty important, right? That the pilots are dead. And then on flight 93, which I'll get into in a little bit, there's one person who describes the pilots being pulled out of the cockpit, but it's very vague and fuzzy and contradicts what all the other callers were saying.
Yes, in fact, if I may interject, one of the things that stuck out to me from your presentation, which I've kind of gathered over the years, but I've never really assembled this information like you have, is the contradictions between various callers, including even what was taking place at the front and whether people are dead or stabbed or sprayed or what. I mean, it's when you start lining it up, it's just crazy, the contradictions even between callers within the same flight.
Yeah, indeed. And so with 93, because we have so many callers, we have lots of contradictions to shine a light on. So at 9:28, the plane is supposedly taken over, and a couple minutes later, phone calls start coming from, you know, ostensibly coming from the plane. And, you know, somebody, the first person to call, his name is Thomas Burnett, called his wife and says, the plane's been hijacked, a passenger has been stabbed. Right, call the authorities is basically what he says to her. It's a very brief call. It's like, okay, interesting, because this, so it's a 757, this is a Boeing 757-200. It is a passenger jet, but it's not a terribly large passenger jet. And, you know, there's a photo of it that I provided, which we can show your audience. Just looking at it from the front of first class all the way to the back, like you can see the back pretty easily from the front of first class. Okay, so it's not a large plane. And yet, so there was this loud, violent struggle that went on for at least a minute in the cockpit, and yet nobody on the plane reports that struggle happening. And the first person who I just mentioned calls his wife and says, oh, a passenger has been stabbed. Okay, a little strange. Then we get a flight attendant a couple minutes later named Sandra Bradshaw calls a United Airlines office and basically says, plane has been hijacked. The hijackers attacked a flight attendant, but none of the crew and none of the passengers are injured. Okay. And this is, by the way, this is all mostly coming, like 90-95% of this information is coming from reports, from interviews that the FBI did with all of the people who received these calls. And then there's not a transcript of the interview. It's just written up in the report. Right. But even from that, and so there's a lot of opportunity for manipulation or certainly a lot of opportunity for details and nuances to be left out or to be, you know, misrepresented, of course. But even with that, there's a lot when we put all this together that there's actually a lot of important contradictions, and there's also some major consistencies that we can start to see. So that by and large, this body of evidence actually seems fairly reliable. And I can get into that more in a little bit. So As we basically go on, I think the most important in terms of the connection to this alleged hijacking, this alleged takeover at 9:28, is you get three or four callers a little bit later, that basically report the plane being taken over now at the moment that they're calling. So at 9:45, one of those is Jeremy Glick, who basically tells his wife, oh, the hijackers are going to the front now. The other is sort of Todd Beamer, who's famous for saying, let's roll, reportedly. That one is the most specific, like where he's talking to a woman named Lisa Jefferson at GTE, the phone company for the that ran the Airphone system. And he says, you know, this is about at 9:45, and he says, the hijackers are getting ready to enter the cockpit. They're getting ready to take over the plane. And then she said in the FBI report, it's noted that she estimated that about 7 minutes later, so let's say at around 9:52, 24 minutes after the alleged takeover, he says, they're now entering the cockpit, right? And they, okay, and now they pulled the pilots out. And then remarkably, you have Sandra Bradshaw, who was the first flight attendant to make that call maybe 15 minutes earlier, around 9:35. She then calls her husband at about 9:50 and speaks with him for 8 minutes. He's an airline pilot. And so he's asking her lots of questions about what's going on because he actually understands like what would happen in a plane, what would happen during a hijacking. And she basically tells him that she assumes that the pilots are still in control of the plane, in the cockpit and control of the plane, and that the hijackers are just sitting in first class. They're just sitting up there, right? But she thinks that the pilots are still in control flying the plane. How on earth, if there is a hijacking, if there's a takeover, a loud violent struggle at 9:28, would presumably everybody, my contention is that everybody in the plane, if they don't hear it or see it, would very quickly find out about it, and certainly a flight attendant would. And then there's the three other people just minutes before her reporting that the hijackers just entered the cockpit or around the same time that she's making her call. And yet she thinks that the pilots are still in the cockpit and in control of the plane. Todd Beamer, who was very specific about, oh, they're getting ready to enter the cockpit now. Oh, now they just entered the cockpit, was sitting one seat in front of her, allegedly, like in terms of not where they started on the flight, but where they made the calls from. They could trace back based on the phone records provided by GTE, they could trace back where the people were sitting, which seats they made the calls from. Beamer was sitting one row in front of Sandra Bradshaw, telling, literally at the same time they're on the phone, one of them is saying, they're entering the cockpit now, and the other is saying, I think the pilots are still in control of the plane. And to make it even more ridiculous, Beamer is supposedly getting all the information from a flight attendant sitting next to him. So this flight attendant would presumably be conversing with Sandra Bradshaw, who's sitting one seat behind her, and their coworkers. And yet, everybody's on a completely different wavelength about what's happening on the plane. So that's sort of just a snapshot. There's many other things. As you mentioned, very contradictory reports of violence. You know, one person talking about a passenger being stabbed. The guy who I mentioned, Burnett, who first called his wife and said the guy is stabbed, calls a few minutes later and says, oh, now he's dead. And yet none of the people around him, imagine if you're sitting on a plane that's been hijacked and somebody was stabbed and then dies right across the aisle from you. You would probably, if you were on the phone with your wife, you might tell your wife that somebody just died. But all the people that were sitting near Burnett, who was supposedly taking care of this stabbed dead man, none of them mentioned that somebody had just died next to them, including Jeremy Glick, who was on the phone with his wife for 20 minutes, allegedly. So this is the ridiculousness that is you can see in the phone calls when you actually start to pay attention to what was being reported in them.
There's so much more detail. And as I say, even as myself, as someone who's looked at various reports, and I have that book by J.M. Berger that puts together all the FBI 302s, and you read through it, and it's just a mass of information, and it's a lot of work to go through and put it together like this. So I do appreciate that, and would once again highly recommend that people take a look at the presentation you made at the symposium where you lay it out flight by flight and give the specific details. But having said that, okay, a couple of things. First of all, probably one of the most famous calls is Barbara Olson, and how she did or did not connect, and what, you know, they changed that to say that her connection actually never really happened and 0 seconds and all of that. What did you make of the Barbara Olson phone call?
Yeah, so as I said, I've sort of focused largely in this presentation and my research so far on like what was being reported in the calls. And there are interesting things about what Barbara Olson reported that, and you know, wasn't only allegedly her husband that she spoke with. It was also people at AT&T who connected her to her husband's office. And they said some interesting things similar to Flight 93 about how it sounded like when Barbara Olson called, which was about 20 minutes after the plane was allegedly taken over, that it sounded like the pilots were still flying the plane and not aware of what was going on in the back of the plane, Okay, so yet another example of that. When we start to talk about how the Barbara Olson calls may have been made, we're getting into the technological details, and I and my colleagues are trying to proceed very, very, very deliberately about through that. There is a working hypothesis out there. It was originated by a guy named Robert Wagner, who was a telecommunications expert, that a device called picocells were used definitely on the American Airlines flights and possibly also on the United flights, that basically would allow a cell phone to be routed through the airphone system and down to the ground. And the picocell theory is interesting because it kind of solves the anomalies that exist with the Barbara Olson calls, and also with some of the calls you might be aware of, your viewers might be aware of, where Thomas Burnett, who I mentioned before, who called his wife, reportedly called his wife a handful of times, she reported that she saw his number on her phone, on her caller ID. And yet the plane, when he called, was allegedly at 40,000 feet. So the picocell, if there were a picocell on Flight 93 or a plane that was purporting to be Flight 93 that he was connecting his cell phone through, perhaps there was some kink in the system that allowed his cell phone number to be displayed, even though it was the airphone system that his cell phone was being routed through. In terms of the Barbara Olson calls, it solves a major anomaly because many people have reported, you know, the understanding is that American Airlines was in the process of decommissioning its airphone system. She made the calls certainly at an altitude where it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for cell phone calls to work. But the airphone explanation never made sense because the airphones supposedly didn't work anymore, the handsets. However, there are actually airphone records that were produced by Claircom that were released. I believe it was in 2009 when the 9/11 Commission released a bunch of their records. And these records show, you know, calls being made through the airphone system. But interestingly, this Robert Wagner, who I mentioned before, interpreted that, looking at the detailed information in the records, that the calls were not made from a airphone handset. And so then how were they made? And I won't go into all the details, and I'm still relatively new to them, but essentially the idea would be that, you know, Barbara Olson, she also, when she tried to, there's the famous call that lasted 0 seconds to her husband. That, under this theory, that happened because she tried to call him directly, and the billing system no longer worked. So when she tried to connect, it didn't work. But that she was able to reach him when she made operator-assisted calls. So as I mentioned before, she spoke to an operator, et cetera, et cetera. So when she dialed 0, spoke to an operator, was eventually able to contact her husband, but as the theory goes, using her cell phone to be routed through the airphone system. Now, normally, picocells would not be on airplanes. I think that they were maybe at some point instituted officially later, several years later, 2004, 2007. But the technology existed at that time. So, and the argument goes that that's how the flights were made from American Airlines Flight 11 as well. It's a working theory. I'm not yet completely, you know, as an organization and myself, we're not yet completely, 100% behind that, but we're looking into it. So,
okay. And I suppose, once again, this question goes beyond the bounds and scope of what you're doing in this particular investigation, but the first question that I think anyone who's even slightly on the fence or inclined to be a debunker would have would be, okay, all right, so these phone calls never happened. Then what are they? Are they completely fictitious creations made in some CIA sound studio that were then, broadcast over the phone to operators in real time? How does that work? And I know that one of the pioneers of this research, or at least the one that I know about, David Ray Griffin, for example, was talking about voice manipulation technologies and how they could have been employed in this. And I know that's not going to be necessarily an argument that a lot of people in the debunking world want to hear. In fact, I vividly recall being at the Osaka 9/11 Truth Conference in 2008, I believe it was, when David Ray Griffin was speaking, and when he brought up the idea of voice manipulation technologies making phone calls sound like people that weren't actually talking, etc. Literally, there was an audience member that broke up into hysterics, laughing hysterically at the concept. So anyway, that technology exists, but was it employed on 9/11? Obviously, this is speculative, and as I say, it goes beyond the bounds of establishing what was supposedly said in these conversations. But people are going to ask, okay, so if these phone calls aren't real, what are they?
Yeah. And to be very frank about it, there's essentially, well, I would divide it into two general hypotheses. One is that what you just spoke to, impersonation using voice morphing technology, or perhaps some other electronic or digital means of fabricating the calls. The other is that it was the actual passengers and flight attendants who made these calls, and they were participating in a purported hijacking drill. And so they were given a script or a set of talking points, and they were describing these things to people on the ground, most of whom were people that, you know, their loved ones. So that's sort of the other, you know, let's say competing theory or the other explanation for how these calls were made.
I suppose another one that we could add to that list would be some sort of live hijacking simulation exercise where the passengers weren't in on it, weren't given a script, but they were witnessing something happening and they believed it to be real. Again,
yeah. Yeah, and David Ray Griffin did a little that hypothesis was advanced to some extent by Jim Hoffman, by researchers named Jim Hoffman and Eric Larson. And you know, where for me that hypothesis kind of the weak point of that hypothesis is that when you look at if the passengers and flight attendants were reporting something that they believed to be real that was actually happening in front of them, there would have been much more consistency in what they were describing. And there would have been much more fear, perhaps, and, you know, heard. And so one of the features that I haven't spoken about yet, but again, which your viewers may be familiar with, is that many of the passengers and flight attendants who made these calls were reported as being remarkably calm. And so I, in my presentation, I documented that 11 out of the 18 or 19, however many it was, callers were described as remarkably calm by the people that spoke to them. Barbara Olson being one of them. Her husband on Larry King Live said she was, in retrospect, just remarkably, you know, unbelievably calm. So, again, yeah, so, you know, that really lends itself more to one of the other two hypotheses.
Hi, Mom. It's your son, Mark Bingham. Yeah. There are just weird things in the phone calls, aren't there?
There are, yeah. And so I want to talk, what I find interesting about the Mark Bingham call. So it's very, for people that don't know, it's very odd that when he finally got his, first he spoke with a woman and he called, I believe it was his aunt's house, spoke to a friend of theirs, then spoke to his aunt, then finally got his mom on the phone. And when he got his mom on the phone, he said, "Hi, Mom, this is Mark Bingham." And a lot of people have taken that, have interpreted that as that's evidence of an impersonator. Would somebody who's actually Mark Bingham really introduce themselves that way? In my view, it's possible that somebody in the second scenario who's participating in a hijacking drill and feeling very awkward about telling their mom that they're in a hijacking might introduce himself that way. But what I think is more interesting about that call, or equally interesting at least, is that when she asks him, "So who are these hijackers, Mark?" He doesn't, and this is like described, I'm almost verbatim describing what's in the FBI report. There's like a pause for 5 seconds, and then he says, "You've got to believe me, it's true." And then she says, "I do believe you, Mark, but who are they?" And there's another pause of five seconds or so, and she hears kind of murmuring in the background like someone's talking to him, and then the line disconnects. So basically, Mark Bingham, along with most of the other callers, did not describe anything about the hijackers. No features, no identifying features. And even when he was asked by his mom twice, he was incapable or unwilling of saying anything about the hijackers. So, again,
you could come up with plausible explanations in a real hijacking why someone wouldn't be able to say something, or they thought their life might be in danger, or blah, blah, blah. There's a million situations we could invent in our head about what's going on and why he might say Mark Bingham and all of this sort of stuff. But it is still points to ponder, And as you say, I think it's not just one particular phone call. It is the aggregation of all of them, which do not seem to add up to a consistent, coherent story that looks anything like the official narrative of 9/11. Okay, anything else you want to say about the phone calls before we start wrapping things up? Keeping in mind, of course, once again, I'm going to exhort everyone to go and watch your actual presentation with all of the details about all of the calls. But anything else that really springs to mind for you?
Yeah, I just wanted one more thing I would want people to take away, because my hope here is that people will become more kind of well-versed in, like, what are the aspects of the phone calls that completely undermine the official story. And the other big one is just that on Flight 11, Betty Ong and Madeline Sweeney, the two flight attendants in Flight 11, describe basically a wildly unrealistic hijacking situation. They basically claim in the course of the phone calls that they made that that three people, two flight attendants, and then a passenger have been stabbed, and the passenger has been stabbed in the neck and is bleeding out and dying, and Mace has been released in first class, and so everybody in first class and business class has made their way into coach class, and yet the people in coach have no idea that there is a hijacking going on. They just think that there's a medical emergency. And that is just absolutely, like, wildly unrealistic and plausible that, you know, the people from first class wouldn't start telling the people in coach what was going on, et cetera, et cetera. And so other researchers hypothesize that, you know, that claim was made because there had to be some reason to explain why more people were not making phone calls from Flight 11. The other aspect of the Flight 11 that is crazy is that allegedly flight attendants were going up to trying to get into the cockpit. And Betty Ong was reporting during the 25-minute call that she made, and she was just hanging out on the phone for 25 minutes and not doing anything else, that people, the flight attendants could not get into the cockpit. And it's like, so they basically were not, as they were going up to the cockpit, there were no hijackers there stopping them from getting to the cockpit. And Betty Ong kept saying, we don't know where they are. They've sort of disappeared. And so we're supposed to basically imagine that all five of the hijackers on Flight 11 and the two pilots, because they don't describe any pilots lying on the ground, they don't say anything about what happened to the pilots, are like stuffed in the cockpit together. So just really for people to, I hope people can remember those and take those away as really obvious falsehoods, things that show you that the story of what happened on Flight 911 is, on Flight 11 is totally false. So.
And of course, that only adds to all the million other aviation impossibilities that were happening in the skies that was part of that symposium, and that, again, you're only scratching the surface of with regards to the actual maneuvers of the flights and whether they were physically possible and all of these sorts of things. So, yeah, there's a lot for people to dig their teeth into if they are so inclined. But I guess this is the sort of the point of the conversation where I'm going to need a little bit of white pill from you as obviously someone with the International Center for 9/11, just as someone who is deeply involved in this research, and thank you for doing this. I know it's a lot of work, but it can be pretty thankless work. And I'm going to go out on a limb and make a bold prediction that there will not be a single piece of feedback to this conversation that is in any way positive or thankful. No one is going to say, thank you, Ted. This was really informative. I learned a lot. Now, having said that, because I have a contrarian audience, there will be at least a couple people in the audience who will be like, okay, I will leave a thank you. So they will be the exceptions that prove the rule that 99% of the feedback to a conversation like this one is going to be along the lines of, but what about the buildings? And then people will start debating each other endlessly about the way that the buildings blew up. Or there will be the people who will be talking about, no, there were no planes, it was all holograms. And then there will be the third type of person, who cares? Whatever, you should be talking about immigrants eating dogs, which was actually a piece of feedback I received about my most recent 9/11 post on Corporate Report. So, I feel increasingly despondent about the state of 9/11 truth. And the real potential for us to break through the stuck-on-stupid conversation that we've been having for 23 years that has not accomplished 9/11 justice, to break through to a real, widespread, mass understanding of the incredible fraud that took place 23 years ago that didn't just take the lives of the 3,000 people on 9/11, but of course, the millions that resulted from the war on terror afterwards, the construction of the police state. Again, I get excited and very angry about this because this was the thing that sent me down the rabbit hole 20 years ago to start investigating this sort of stuff and to start doing the corporate report in the first place. And when I talk about it these days, pretty much a collective shrug. So you need to give me the white pill. What do you see in terms of people out there and their appetite for this information and their ability to absorb new information about 9/11?
Yeah, well, I think your audience obviously is very well informed about 9/11 by and large, and probably like you and like me, frustrated, you know, at the lack of, or the seeming lack of progress over the last, say, 15 to 20 years, and wondering where is this going to go? Are we ever going to achieve that sort of immense awakening, you know, that you just described, and that I think is the reason why we all do this and why you started doing it. I around me every day, just in day-to-day life, in sort of the mainstream world out there, the so-called normies, like, I see much more openness to 9/11 truth, you know, considering, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, that 9/11 was an inside job, that 9/11 was a false flag attack. Pretty much like 9 out of 10 people that I introduce myself to these days, like, are anywhere from neutral and interested to completely on board and supportive, right? So there's that. Like, I think we're getting to a point where, you know, we're far enough away. People are more open to it. We have an entire younger generation, et cetera. And then I think online, I think we're seeing a massive, you know, in sort of the alternative media, you know, or the, even let's say, I mean, you've been doing this incredible reporting for 15 plus years, right? But in the sort of, and you're very well, I think very well known and respected, in the sort of mainstream alternative media that has kind of sprung up over the last 5 to 10 years, like, we are starting to see people really talk about this much more frequently, much more openly. You know, I could run through the list of names, but, you know, your audience is probably familiar with them, the figures out there who've been speaking about this. So I think we are actually close to getting closer to some sort of a tipping point where it basically won't be taboo, at least won't be taboo at all anymore to talk about this, at least in the alternative media or in, like, alternative sort of internet spaces. And I think that that's going to gradually spill over to the mainstream as well. You know, I just, you know, did a couple interviews with George Galloway, British politician, pundit, who for many years was afraid to talk about 9/11. And now he's talking about it. Neil Oliver, relatively new arrival to the scene, very interested in COVID, and is now suddenly talking about 9/11. We have the case of the family in the UK, the family of Jeff Campbell. Jeff Campbell died in the North Tower on 9/11, and his family is still trying to open a new inquest into his murder. And, you know, we're at a point in that case where, you know, we are actually, and I understand people's pessimism without a doubt, I totally understand it, but we are at a point where there is actually a decent chance of this family's case actually being accepted and the family within the next year or two actually getting the new inquest where we can prove that Jeff Campbell was killed in the demolition of the North Tower, and that will be the legal cause of his death, which would, you know, send, I think, tidal waves in all directions of awareness and so on. So yeah, I think that there is reason to keep fighting, and I think, you know, let's use JFK as an example. Like, people kept learning things for decades and decades, and, you know, to the point now where the vast majority of the public believes that it was, you know, not Lee Harvey Oswald who killed JFK. Has anything come of that? No, but I think 9/11 perhaps, 9/11 as an event is perhaps has greater potential than even JFK did if we get to that level of awareness. And I think we're in a different environment now where information spreads so quickly and we are managing to overcome the censorship by and large, you know, so I think that there is reason to keep fighting. I think people should be hopeful. And let's at least give this another 10 years or so and see where we get. Because if we crack this open in the next 10 years, it's still close enough to when the crime took place for it to have a massive impact on our society.
Well, thank you for that very whitish gray pill. I do appreciate that because, yes, I think you're absolutely and obviously right that the absolute toxic stigma of even mentioning anything that whiffed of 9/11 truth that absolutely existed 20 years ago and which would have gotten someone immediately canceled from whatever mainstream network or whatever they were on, that stigma has been removed. And there are more and more people as you say, in the mainstream alternative media that are starting to speak about it. And now, well, thank you for joining the party 20 years late. But anyway, at least you're here. So, yes, I am glad to see that happening. And I think you're right. But at the same time, it's funny you bring up JFK, because that's exactly the way that I think about this, is that in the JFK case, the vast majority of the American public for decades, documentably, in poll after poll after poll, have believed there was some conspiracy. Oswald was not a lone nut. The vast majority of people know it, but that hasn't changed the mainstream conversation on that at all, and it hasn't changed anything in terms of actually achieving justice. And that's my fear for 9/11. We might actually arrive at the point where the vast majority of people, in fact, even early polls in New York, most people said the government lied about 9/11. There was 53% or whatever in a poll in 2006. So, yes, most people have been on board with some variant of 9/11 truth for a very long time, and more people joining the party every day. But will it achieve justice? And I guess let's end on that note. Again, this is the International Center for 9/11 Justice. What is 9/11 justice, and how can it actually be achieved? For example, you bring up the Campbell inquest possibility. That's an incredible opportunity, but I hope people understand the meaning of an opportunity like that, because it is through court actions like that, whatever the judge gavels down on, ultimately, at the very least, opens up this entire possibility for new documents and new information to come out. This is how we get more information about events like these. It was through the Moussaoui trial and other things like this that we got lots of documents that we didn't have before and learned new aspects of the case. I think that is something that we can at least be striving towards as an interim goal. But what is the ultimate end goal of 9/11 justice?
Well, I think 9/11 justice means much more than sort of like a result in an outcome in a legal proceeding. When we use the term 9/11 justice, we are talking about a widespread realization and reckoning about what actually happened on 9/11. That is impossible for the powers that be to suppress and to impossible for them to prevent from transforming into not just awareness, but actual action. I do happen to believe that 9/11 is a much more, in terms of the psyche of our of the U.S. and of the world, that 9/11 lives much deeper than the assassination of JFK. And that if we get to a place where 60-70%, etc., of people believe that it was a false flag attack, well, not only will that make us a much more informed populace, much more skeptical, rightly so. But I think because of what 9/11 represented and still continues to have the impact that it does, and I think people can feel it, even though people want to dismiss that. But I think that we'll see a different result when we get to that level of awareness than what we've seen with JFK. So that's why we keep at it. And in terms of looking at things like the phone calls and the hijackings, these kinds of discoveries are important for reaching new people. The more that we learn, the more because a lot of people are tired of hearing about controlled demolition. Yeah, let's talk about how the hijackers could not possibly have flown the planes. Very simple idea. Let's get that idea out there and let's prove it rigorously, which we as an organization are working on, because that will reach new people that weren't convinced by the controlled demolition. So the research is about raising awareness, ultimately, and figuring out what exactly happened that day. And the more we figure out, the more people will be woken up. So,
excellent answer. I very much resonate with the idea of 9/11 justice is not just about some court opinion. It's about the court of public opinion to completely transform people's understanding of the events of 9/11, not only to achieve the justice in the historical record of actually having the truth documenting what actually happened on that day, but then also to use that information going forward so that magic trick of false flag terrorism can never be used to lead the public into illegal wars of aggression ever again. And that to me would be the real justice that we can achieve if we push this through to its completion. So my hat's off to you and all the people who are still working on this and looking for new information and new ways to bring this to the public's attention. I think it is important. And on that note, if people are at all interested in what you talked about today, once again, the link to the full symposium will be in the show notes for this interview so that people can go and watch not only your presentation, but Aidan Monahan and Kevin Ryan and the other presenters there with lots more information and detail. And let's just keep pushing this through until we achieve 9/11 justice. On that note, Ted Walter, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, James.